They have no guarantees about returning or not returning, and it is unsafe for them to stay abroad, and it's also unsafe for them potentially to return home.
Welcome to Foreign Policy. I'm James Palmer, FP's senior editor, and you're listening to The ER. Joining me in Washington today is FP's correspondent for All Things China, Bethany Allen Ebrahimian. Over the past few months, Bethany has published numerous stories about China's influence on U.S. universities. With us over Skype is FP contributor Zach Dorfman. Zach recently published a piece for FP called The Disappeared, detailing the Chinese government's worldwide kidnapping and coercion campaign to bring Chinese expats home. Both of these actions signal that the Chinese government, even as it grows more autocratic at home, is expanding its reach abroad, whether through buying influence at universities and among academics, or through more threatening methods, such as the forced repatriation through kidnapping of former Chinese citizens. The Chinese government is attempting to stretch its long arm as far as it can. Bethany, let's talk about the universities first of all. Now, obviously, you know, all foreign governments try to some extent, influence the global discourse and the German Goethe Institutes, the British Council and so on. What makes these Chinese campaigns different?
Well, the Chinese campaigns have an element of coercion to them. So if we're talking about, you know, the Chinese Students and Scholars Associations, the Chinese embassies keep very close tabs on them, keep up very close relationships with them, give them lots of money. And with the money comes the understanding that if you don't help us when we ask you to, we'll take that money away. For example, last year, the embassy asked many CSSAs around the U.S. to post very ideological articles into their social media groups and to hold these ideological events to go along with the party congress. So there's this understanding, you know, you're from China, you understand how this works. If you decide not to do this, what's going to happen? You know, maybe you'll go back to China, you'll try to get a job with a state-owned enterprise, and you won't get it. The difference if you're, you know, talk about like the Goethe Institute or, you know, the U.S.'s like National Endowment for Democracy, those don't have that kind of pat on the back and a kind of, you know, while you're kind of, you know, gripping the other person's arm extremely tightly. It's, you know, it doesn't have that kind of coercion to it.
So these are forms of sort of soft social pressure, relatively speaking. It's not so much that there are clear limits or clear restrictions, but that your Chinese students are made very conscious that they're part of a political discourse that includes China back home, a country that's getting increasingly repressive, particularly for academic and political careers.
Well, that's one aspect of it. So I know I wrote one very sort of deep dive on the CSSAs, but there are other aspects of it too that are less well understood because there are more obvious, you know, attempts to threaten. You know, for example, a well-known Chinese dissident based here in the U.S. was holding a salon to talk about, you know, Tiananmen, maybe talk about Taiwan. And, you know, Chinese people that this person didn't know came in and started taking photos of the attendees. Who are they? What are they going to do with those photos? Where are they going to send them? So there's these intimidation campaigns that also happen. You know, sort of, this is sort of a different track of influence, if you will. I think for Chinese students anywhere around the world, there's the understanding that they did not leave the Chinese state behind them when they left China.
So, Zach, your piece talks, too, about these methods of coercion, about ways in which people are forced back to China or persuaded to come back in difficult cases. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. And I think this is, you know, of a piece with Bethany's work on, you know, kind of China's ideas about its extraterritorial jurisdiction and the ways in which it feels like it has the right or the authority to surveil and in some senses control the activities of individuals of Chinese descent abroad. And the piece that I published at FP was a deep dive into, I would say, the sharper point of the spear in terms of these coercive techniques. And those are up to and including alleged kidnappings of Chinese nationals or individuals of Chinese descent in a number of countries worldwide going back to the mid-1990s. The cases that were previously publicly known went back to, I think, 1993, 1994. The first one that I was able to find was in Macau, which was then under Portuguese control. And over time, what multiple former intelligence community officials told me from the United States, Australia, and Canada was that there was an expanding Chinese coercion campaign that included threats to people's families back home, remote coercion via the phone or other methods, and then up to and including actual in-person kidnappings where Chinese operatives, most likely MPS or MSS officers or agents, would drag somebody onto a boat. They would drug them, they would hit them over the head, drag them onto a boat, and ship them out to China.
So, I mean, with these forced kidnappings, they literally just depended upon sticking somebody in a crate on a boat and hoping that nobody on the US side saw it. How difficult are these things to find? How difficult is it to sort of spot somebody being forcibly taken out of the country?
Well, I think in certain circumstances it would be quite difficult. In other ones, they are done more surreptitiously. I should say that in the U.S. cases, there was never proof from the former intel and folks that I spoke with of those kinds of boat-oriented kidnapping. That was Australia in particular. You know, Australia, as was put to me, has a very large coastline, and the way that the kidnappings occurred there, according to one former Chinese diplomat who defected, was in at least one case, this person was dragged onto a small boat, and then out at sea, there was a Chinese state shipping liner that person was transferred onto. The U.S. cases are a little bit different, as far as I understand. These are cases where, and these are cases that seem to have been replicated in places like Canada as well, where some suspected MSS or MPS operatives, again, would show up. They would show up at somebody's work or their school. One case in the story that I discuss is a graduate student at the University of California at Berkeley. And they would basically say to these people, you have 24 hours, you're getting on a plane with us.
So the implication being that if they didn't get on the plane, worse things would happen to them or to their families.
Exactly. And there are, you know, there were instances of, you know, specific threats. For instance, there was a case in Egypt that was reported in this piece about a Uyghur family that was told that if they did not return, their entire family back in China would be thrown in prison and their property would be expropriated. If they did return to China, their family would be unharmed and their property would be left as is, and they would also be left unharmed. What apparently ended up occurring, according to a close family member of this couple, was that they did return to China out of fear of their family's safety, and they were immediately thrown in prison.
So these premises can't necessarily be trusted too, of course. I mean, there's always this, so I guess there's always this gamble if you're a dissident or particularly a Uyghur abroad, like do I cooperate in the hope of sparing others, or do I continue resisting because these people aren't trustworthy anyway?
I think that's very much the case, and I think that's part of the squeeze that has been being put on these individuals. Is they don't know, they have no guarantees about returning or not returning, and it is unsafe for them to stay abroad, and it's also unsafe for them potentially to return home. So it's a case where people are being put in extraordinarily adverse situations, and many times these cases have gone unreported.
So we've seen in both these cases the university influence, the kidnappings, the coercion. We see this sense of ownership that China has over not just its own citizens, but people who are often former Chinese citizens in some cases, or even just people of Chinese descent. And we've seen that being talked about more and more in Chinese state rhetoric, the idea that the Chinese diaspora should be under the influence, under the control of Beijing. I think, you know, at the same time, we're now seeing in Washington a real turn against engagement with China, a real turn against the idea that, a real turn towards the idea that Chinese policy over the last sort of 15, 20 years on the U.S. side has in some way failed. I'm not certain whether that's true or not. That's really a topic for another podcast. But with definitely this sort of who lost China 2.0 idea coming up. Now, a lot of these people are people who are either American citizens or resident in the U.S. or who the U.S. has an interest in protecting, and certainly an interest in protecting academic freedom, both in the U.S. and hopefully worldwide, though under this administration that's always a little bit doubtful. What can the U.S. do about these kind of programs. What can the U.S. do, for instance, about these attempts to influence Chinese students on American campuses?
I think the U.S., first of all, I mean, politicians need to speak out about it. The more that the Chinese students here know that it's not just within their community that they're talking about it. If they hear, you know, American politicians talking about it, if they were to hear the president or, you know, a different president than the one we have talking about it, if they were to see more media articles about it, if their own university administrations were to make statements about it saying we will not tolerate, you know, foreign government threats, intimidation, or interference on our own campuses, I think that would make a huge difference for Chinese students. Chinese students feel completely alone here. I mean, a lot of what I've written in my pieces are kind of are basically an open secret, you know, in the Chinese diaspora communities here. But people outside of those communities have no idea. And I think for Chinese communities to know that U.S. society, that American society is on their side and will fight for them, would really help give them a lot of confidence and help embolden them to maybe make a stand. As it is, I think that Chinese students here feel like they don't. There is no other option. That's why you see basically, you know, almost total silence from Chinese students. And we reread that, political silence, unless it's for a patriotic reason. So, for example, at UCSD last year, when the Chinese Students and Scholars Association and other Chinese students on campus made a real uproar about the university inviting the Dalai Lama to come give a talk. And so we hear Chinese students, you know, doing what students do and protesting something. But there wasn't, you know, there was no group of Chinese students who were like, well, actually, you know, we have different thoughts about it. Or maybe on other issues, you know, we never hear from the sort of, you know, Chinese students who would have opinions that wouldn't go with Beijing. And I don't think that's organic.
And I mean, there's real risk, not just from the government, but socially for Chinese students who do try to take different positions. I remember about a decade ago, there was a case of a Chinese student who attempted to get between a group of pro-Tibetan and anti-Tibetan protesters.
Ooh.
And who ended up being the target of a human flesh search, a doxing in China, whose parents were harassed to the point that they divorced.
Wow.
Who really paid a huge social and personal cost herself for getting involved in these issues.
Well, speaking of doxing, I mean, that happened just last year at University of Maryland. There was a Chinese student, a graduate, who gave a talk at commencement. And she said, you know, I love this, you know, democratic, free American air. You know, I learned, you know, all about freedom and democracy when I came to the U.S. And she was just eaten alive on the Chinese internet. They posted the address of her family in China. They, you know, she was just overwhelmed by an outpouring of, you know, terrible comments online on the Chinese internet.
Which, of course, I mean, that can happen anywhere. People on the internet are awful all over the world. But in China, there's no pushback against this. The sort of rabidly pro-government, pro-patriotic side is now the only side that's allowed in Chinese online discourse because it's been so crippled by Beijing over the course of the last few years. So whereas elsewhere there might be, in cases such as Gamergate, say in the US, there's been a pushback, there's been support even from the authorities in some cases, though ineptly. In China, the authorities are on the side of the sort of cyberbullies.
Right, and it's not like there's some kind of nonprofit legal fund that her parents can apply to, and it's, you know, they can't start their own. Exactly. I mean, that's a great point.
So, Zach, turning back to this issue of sort of what the US can do, the US has been very silent about these coercion campaigns, at least publicly. We've heard some talk that it might be discussed more openly in the future. Do you think that would achieve anything?
I do. I think the most important thing is there's the naming and shaming component of it, right? Which means that the U.S. and its allies could make it very clear that they are aware of what Chinese operatives are doing on foreign soil, and to push back against it, because you're talking about a series of potentially, you know, heinous human rights violations. And moreover, I think that doing so would potentially create a thaw, which would make individuals and their families who have been subject to these campaigns potentially feel like they can go and speak to law enforcement officials in the U.S. and elsewhere, which I think would be really important, because I think that there's been a systematic underestimation of how how fearful some of these communities are here of a government that is thousands of miles abroad. I mean, I will say also on the prior point, I think there's another thing that could have been done, and it hasn't been done yet. I think it might be wise to do in the future, which is to actually come down harder on suspected Chinese operatives that are engaging in these sorts of activities domestically. And that means these individuals, even if it doesn't rise to the level of kidnapping, they are breaking U.S. law, for instance. I mean, they are committing extortion. There are anti-menacing statutes. If they are government officials here on government business, they are committing visa fraud. And there are instances where I heard from former Intel sources that there has been discussion about this, but understandably, to some extent, the CIA and State Department was wary of taking these kind of harsher actions because of fears about their own officials and operatives abroad.
On the Chinese side, in fact, a recent survey showed that Chinese believe that approximately 6% of foreigners in China are spies. There are extensive propaganda campaigns in China about supposed foreign spies, you know, warning against handsome foreign devils who will sweep innocent young Chinese girls off their feet and seduce security secrets from them. So, you know, is there a feeling on the US side that American students, Americans doing business in China, all these groups could be at potential risk if they push harder at home?
That I have not heard, but my understanding was that the primary fear was about, you know, people, you know, undercover CIA operatives abroad, for instance. You know, there was a case that I think was revealed publicly in Politico in the last year or two of a CIA officer in China who was, I think, beaten and detained in China for some period of time. And I think that, you know, there is a, you know, the spy war with Russia has been getting a great deal of attention for a very good reason. But the situation in China is also pretty, I wouldn't say dire, but it has become increasingly antagonistic over time. And I think that there are real concerns about that.
Let's talk about that Russia-China comparison for a moment. So, of course, we have all this attention on Russia at the moment because Russia is basically, you know, the sort of 4chan of countries. I mean, it's a massive troll.
Ultimate shitlord was the way somebody.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's really just not just you know, taking these actions, but then has this kind of defiant tone about them. And we saw that in the UK with the poisoning recently, where Russia, you know, poisoned somebody on UK soil, proceeded to start a disinformation campaign about it, having it ready to go through bots and so on, and then to kind of blithely deny it and try and demand access to his widow as a Russian citizen while she was being protected by UK security forces. So it's not just these actions itself, it's this sort of in-your-face tone about it. But is China, so we've seen all these things from Russia, but is China in some ways a more serious long-term threat, Bethany?
Well, you know, it's interesting. So I just got back from Moscow a couple of weeks ago where I was talking with Russian government officials about the poisoning incident in Britain and many other topics. And it struck me how brazen their official line on the poisoning was. Their official line that I kept getting was, you know, the news of the poisoning is a Western disinformation campaign, which was really bold, I thought. No, but so as, you know, as more of a...
Whereas in China, they would have just been, we have no knowledge of the incident to which you refer, as the foreign ministry likes to say on press occasions, you know. Like a meteorite has just landed in Beijing and aliens are spilling out and they'll be there and it's like, you know, we have not been informed of this incident. I'd love to see a Chinese version of Mars Attacks, actually. You can't actually destroy China in movies, of course, because then if you show like the Forbidden City being wrecked or any of this kind of thing, you won't be allowed onto the Chinese market. Anyway, that diversion aside, Bethany, it's a...
So it was interesting kind of getting an inside look at the Russian government and their foreign policy and their strategy. And, you know, if I were to compare it to China, I would say that Russia is like a pufferfish. You know, it's a little pufferfish that knows how to like poof itself up so it looks really big and scary. And, you know, the U.S. is like, oh, my God, Russia, it's so scary. And China, I don't know, China's like the opposite. It looks like a very nice, friendly,
You're running out of fish.
I'm
here,
running
aren't
out
you?
Of
I,
fish.
I can see the. We'll fill in the fish
it,
later.
It looks like a very nice, friendly snake, but it's actually an anaconda. I don't know. It's the opposite. So what? I mean, China very.
It's a koala bear. It looks cuddly, but in fact, the little bastards are full
koala.
Of claws. They don't need to be poisonous. Trust me, koalas are vicious.
So the point is that, you know, there's this famous phrase, what is it, Tao Guang Yan Hui or something, means, you know, to basically hide your strength, you know, hide and bide your time until you're stronger. And so China, you know, so much of what it does, what Russia does, I think it does, you know, in order to play the spoiler, you know, to distract, to cause fear. And China does the opposite. It wants to gain as much power as it can. It wants to gain as much influence as it can quietly before people realize what's happening. And if you look at, if you just look at their population, I mean, Russia has like, what, 120 million people? China has 1.3 billion people. If you look at the size of their economies, I mean, China is pretty soon going to surpass the U.S. probably in terms of its economic size. You know, Russia is what, like number 8 or 10?
Lower, I think, 15, you know.
In the world. I mean, really, it's not, you know, it's not some kind of huge economic player like it once was. So if you just look at the sheer amount of power that these two countries have, I mean, there's absolutely no comparison. So 50 years from now, I mean, who's going to be the U.S.'s main competitor 20 years from now or right now? It's obviously China. They're an ascendant power. And personally, I get very frustrated with this obsession with Russia.
And I think, too, you know, we've seen these softer forms of Chinese influence already in things like Western corporations changing things to Taiwan, a province of China.
Right.
And things like the, again, as I alluded to earlier, the way that Hollywood basically follows Chinese censorship restrictions in order to make sure its movies can enter into the Chinese market. So there's soft power, there's economic power is there anyway. Even if we leave aside these harder actions, that too is something that I think Americans and others in democratic societies could be more concerned about. Zach, talking of Russia, why do you think that there's been such U.S. obsession with Russia, in particular with these disinformation campaigns, which, you know, frankly, many of them seem to have effectively been Facebook shitposting? I mean, what made this sort of idea of Russian threat, Russian scariness, so much more powerful than Chinese influence?
I mean, decades of anti-Soviet hysteria in the United States is part of it. Some of it was well-founded. Obviously, especially during the Stalinist period, there was there was a lot of evil regimes in the 20th century, but that certainly is, if not, I mean, it's if not first among equals, then up there. And I think that there is just a more deeply embedded anti-Russia.
The Russians were the villains in movies for a lot longer than the Chinese have ever been.
Getting back to your Hollywood
point,
be the villains in Hollywood movies.
Well, I was thinking too. You know, look, there's this level at which this Chinese stuff, because it's confined to the Chinese American community, because it's confined in many cases to overseas communities abroad, it doesn't feel like it affects most people. There's a sort of isolation about it. Whereas the Russian stuff, because it hit upon, you know, also, you know, the U.S.'s decision to cover itself in petrol and set itself alight democratically. because it hit at this moment that touches everyone, and you know, everyone saw, you know, got involved in these goddamn stupid online fights and meme spreading and all this sort of thing. So is there a sense in which the Russian stuff touches our daily life and the Chinese stuff doesn't?
I think that's I think that's potentially true for now. I think there are two things. First of all, China has been much more successful at surreptitiously doing that kind of perception management in ways that I think the Russians have been quite envious of. There has been a successful attempt in many cases to make the Chinese people synonymous with the Chinese Communist Party. And so there are different ways to try and do disinformation or influence campaigns. And the Chinese have done it one way and the Russians have done it another in their kind of, you know, 4chan ultimate shitlord way. I would say the other important point is that I think that we are at a crux right now where China has been so focused traditionally on its internal security. In fact, it's been focused on the very thing that Russia experienced, which was the destruction of its empire. Now it feels it is emboldened. And what I've heard from, you know, former intelligence community officials, for instance, is that, you know, the Ministry of State Security has been disproportionately focused on internal security, even though it's their primary foreign intelligence gathering arm. But in the last 5 years or so, that's really changed. And they are updating themselves into a, you know, contemporary major, you know, CIA or SVR equivalent. And I think we're going to start seeing much more activity along the lines of what we've seen from Russia out of China in the next 10 or 15 years. I mean, that's a bit of speculation on my part, but I think that the conditions are now right for that kind of activity.
So I wanted to pick up finally on this point about the party and the people. Now, one of the concerns that's been raised over discussion of Chinese influence is the danger of racism, especially at a time when, you know, obviously racism in the US feels as though it's in some ways on the ascendant, when racists are empowered in government, when we've seen, you know, figures such as Steve Bannon, who are explicitly anti-Asian, anti-Chinese racists in positions of influence and positions of power. And there's, you know, although there's a history of anti-Russianness, there's also a history of, you know, yellow peril-dom and fear of China in the West. I've seen, you know, we've heard concern from Chinese American community leaders about language, such as the FBI head talking about the whole of society campaign in the US. How can we talk realistically about Chinese influence and avoid the dangers of sort of slipping into sort of racism or of seeing Chinese as a threat in themselves? Bethany.
Like you said, there's two things going into this. I mean, we do have a history of racism here in the U.S. You know, look at the Japanese internment camps in California during World War II. You know, very strong anti-Asian sentiment. On the other hand, racism plays very handily into the Chinese Communist Party narrative. They bill themselves as the only protector of the Chinese people. You know, we will protect you from foreign hostile forces. You know, count on us to keep you safe at home and abroad. You know, if there starts to be strong racism or even a little bit of racism in the United States and Canada and Australia and New Zealand, the Chinese Communist Party can say, look, see, we told you so. You know, come back to the warm embrace of the party and we will keep you safe. We always told you you couldn't trust those, you know, Western democracies. So it really plays into their hands, which is why I feel like in some cases I don't want to say they fan the flames of racism, but they're very eager to call any criticism of the party racism. So, you know, if you successfully equate the party with Chinese people and then you have someone like me who criticizes the party, then the party can say, you know, if you're speaking against us, you're speaking against all Chinese people, it's racism, you're bad, you know, and then sort of write off the criticism that way. And in Australia, we've seen this has actually been pretty effective. There's, you know, a book, Clive Hamilton just came out with this book with a not great title called Silent Invasion. There's actually a great amount of a large amount of very, very good information in that book with a few unfortunate paragraphs. And the way that, you know, basically among large portions of the population, his name has basically been muddied. You know, his arguments have been equated with racism. So that's, you know, score one for the party.
But I think, you know, is there a chance here for Western governments to say Chinese Americans, even Chinese students here are people too, are people that we need to protect, as it were, from hostile foreign powers. If you're going to come after the Chinese American community, you're coming after our people. You're trying to threaten our values.
Yeah, exactly. And I think in the US, our reluctance to stand up for the Chinese community hints maybe at some underlying inability to accept them as fully American. And that's something that we have to deal with, you know, inside of ourselves, I think, inside of our own society.
Great. Zach, Bethany, thank you very much. I'm James Palmer with The ER for Foreign Policy.